Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm joined tonight for a discussion of The Grand Budapest Hotel by Adam Riske.
Good morning, Budapest!
You should go to our website at fthismovie.net. You can like us on Facebook. You should follow us on Twitter. We're at fthismovie. You can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Find us in the iTunes store just by searching F This Movie. If you're there, you like our show, you're a fan of the show, please take the time to leave a review or a star rating. Every little bit helps. And remember, you can only find all of our past episodes at fthismovie.net. We're going to be talking about Wes Anderson's latest film, The Grand Budapest Hotel. And we'll talk mostly spoiler-free until the very end, when we'll give you lots of notice that we might be talking spoilers. I feel like it's the kind of movie that... It's not a real spoilery movie, but there are some things that I would like to talk about that you should only hear maybe after you've seen the movie, or if you don't plan to see the movie and you want to listen anyway. But before we talk about The Grand Budapest Hotel, Adam Riske.
Yes.
Have you seen anything good lately?
Yeah, I have. The good thing is everything I've seen, good or bad, has been interesting.
Okay.
Lately. And I definitely almost will take that sometimes over kind of a vanilla good movie.
For sure.
So, I'll start out with Muppets Most Wanted.
Yes.
I saw that over the weekend, and it's better than the Muppets and all the people out there who really, really put over the first Muppets.
Yeah.
Like, I was not one of those people.
Yeah.
I thought that it was kind of a movie that bent over backwards trying to remind you why the Muppets were special, when
okay.
It's just like, just do what you do.
Right,
and that's
right.
What they do in The Muppets Most Wanted. It's just, if you don't like the Muppets or like don't have any type of affinity or like relationship with the Muppets,
right.
This isn't a movie for you. It's for people who like and know the Muppets.
If you're not a fan of the Muppets, don't go see a movie with the word Muppets in the title, is what you're saying?
Pretty much. I know there's a lot of Ray Liotta in the trailer. I mean, like, and you do get your Liotta fix.
For your hardcore Liotta files.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, for all you people just watching No Escape on repeat.
Listen, some of us saw Turbulence opening day in the theater.
Man, that's street cred right there.
And it was part of a full day. I saw Turbulence. I saw The Relic.
Uh-huh.
This is all on the same day. I saw Michael.
Uh-huh.
And then I think I stuck around and saw...
Michael again.
Daniel Day-Lewis and Winona Ryder.
Oh, The Crucible.
The Crucible. The only thing that was coming to my mind was The Scarlet Letter, and I knew it wasn't that.
Yeah,
the film adaptation of The Crucible. So that was a hell of a day at the movies.
That sounds like a hell of a day at the movies. Do you want to hear some kind of fun facts about, a fun fact about The Relic?
Of course I do. I like The Relic.
A kid that I went to Hebrew school with, was his only acting credit was in The Relic. He was
nice.
One of the two kids who got, like, lost in the museum.
I kind of remember.
Stalked by the monster.
Yeah.
And I made fun of him a lot because that kid was a douchebag. And, like, he wouldn't let me copy off of his Hebrew school test. And he was always like, stop copying. And I'm like, it's Hebrew school. Relax. And Mr. like North Shore, I'm a big actor. Like, he's like, I'm in The Relic. And
yeah.
I'm like, yeah, you weren't even good in The Relic.
I like The Relic.
Yeah.
But not that kid.
I remember
that kid is garbage.
Right. That kid was garbage. Yeah. If you look him up, you'll find out what his name is, and I'm sure he'll accept your Facebook request to be a friend. Because
well, now he's getting talked about on a prominent movie podcast.
Exactly. So if you're listening, Dave Grobart, you weren't a very nice person growing up, and you should let me copy off your Hebrew school test. So back to the Muppets.
Yes.
Yeah, so I thought it was really funny,
okay.
And I wasn't expecting that, because I like...
Sorry.
The Muppet movie. I think it's a terrific movie and
the
very
original.
Funny. The original, yeah.
Yeah.
But I usually think the Muppets are more cute than funny, but there's
sure. A
lot of jokes in this one that are just, it wouldn't work for kids, but
right.
It's things like, there's like a JB wrote about it in his column today. There's a song that's very reminiscent of like a 70s Bee Gees disco song. And there's a part where like Kermit takes Vaseline and spreads it on the camera lens so it looks more 70s.
Right, right, right.
And like, it's just like little touches like that.
Right.
They've got I won't spoil it, but they've got one of the funniest jokes about that puppet Walter, who was so central to the first Muppet.
Yeah.
It's like a put down of Walter, and it's one of the funniest things that they could have done. So I liked it a lot. They had a cameo by Christoph Waltz, and it was okay, but it kind of bummed me out because I heard that he was originally supposed to have a bigger part in the movie. He was supposed to be the Ty Burrell character.
Oh, okay.
And I was thinking, actually, before I knew that, he would have been great for the Ricky Gervais character. Because
it would have meant that Ricky Gervais wasn't in the movie.
Do you not like Ricky Gervais?
You know, at one point, I did like Ricky Gervais. I thought he was funny, like, on the
Office.
British Office. Yeah. And I actually kind of like the movie where he's the dentist. Okay. No titles are coming to
Ghost
mind right
Town?
Now. Yes, Ghost Town. Yeah. I think that movie's actually kind of good.
Okay.
But he's become mostly insufferable ever since.
Yeah, he's kind of like a pig man a little bit. He's like pig vomit from Private Parts.
WNBC. WNBC.
Yes. But I thought it was better than I thought it would be. It was funny. The music was good. I saw it in a pretty empty theater, and it's always kind of something that I enjoy when you're in a somewhat empty theater for a comedy, but like there are certain jokes that make people like laugh really, really hard.
Okay.
So it was like that for like an hour and a half of just one guy laughing super hard and no one else laughing. And then I would laugh super hard at something and then no one else would laugh. So it was a very interesting dynamic.
Right.
And before the movie, they had a Monsters University short.
Right.
And I'm starting to think that just anything related to Monsters University is wonderful because the short is so funny and charming.
Yeah.
And I'm starting to think because Pixar like only wants to do sequels now.
Yeah.
They might as well just do Incredibles University and Wall-U and just like, just get it. Just keep doing college movies because they seem to have figured that out like really well. But
they got a lot of shit for Monsters University. People didn't like it.
They're idiots. I'm sorry.
I liked it a lot. I was a big fan, but for some reason.
Yeah, I haven't gone back to it, surprisingly enough, but I really want to watch it again.
It's good.
It's good. Yeah. So I saw that. I saw Enemy.
Oh, yeah.
The new Jake Gyllenhaal movie directed by Denis Villeneuve, I think. It's the guy who made Prisoners, and they did this before Prisoners. And it's...
Oh, they did it before Prisoners? I didn't know that.
Yeah. I didn't know that until I did some reading about it. But, it's interesting. It reminds me a lot of, like, Rabid or The Brood. It's kind of like early David Cronenberg thing.
Right.
And the only reason I say that is because it's not like a body horror movie, but it's a lot of, I think the Toronto, like kind of downtrodden, mopey look has a lot to do with it. And it's good. It's creepy. It's, the performances are good. It's definitely a movie that, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Okay.
It's kind of a puzzle movie, and they want you to figure out what's going on and come up with your own interpretation. So I read some essays about it, and some people are saying it's like a comment on totalitarianism or on like feminism, and none of that stuff makes any sense to me with the movie that I saw. And I'm starting to think that it's bad storytelling, because and all the people I've talked to who've seen it have no idea what to make of it, and they almost don't have any theory about it. So that if nobody can kind of get what you're going for, I think that you miss something.
Maybe.
So I don't know, but irregardless, I think just from like a mood perspective, it's worth watching.
Right.
It's one of the better things that I've seen so far this year.
I know nothing about it except that it's the guy that did Prisoners, and Jake Gyllenhaal plays like a dual role, right?
Yeah. Well, if you watch it, you'll know even less about it.
Oh, okay, cool.
Because it just doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
So I'm going to stick with what I know.
Yeah.
And
you get to see Shoshana Dreyfus topless. So
okay.
So there you go.
Okay.
Yeah. Melanie Laurent's pretty cute.
I'm a fan.
I'm a fan, too.
I like her.
So that's all good. But, all right. Now I'm going to go into the weirder stuff that I saw.
Okay,
so I saw Flatliners.
Yeah, you did.
And you've seen Flatliners.
A bunch of times. Yeah. Flatliners, let me throw out a piece of trivia for you.
Yes.
Flatliners, I think, now I'm starting to doubt myself. When my parents split up, we would...
Because of Flatliners?
Well, kind of. the only thing that we would do, like, to see my dad was go to the movies. He would come pick us up. We would go to a movie. Yeah. So this is when I started going to the movies a lot, because prior to that, we'd go once a year. It took my parents divorcing to actually get to go see movies. Mm-hmm. Flatliners was the first movie that we saw. It was either Flatliners. I'm doubting myself now, because it was either Flatliners or Tremors. Man. But I remember it just being like, this is weird. Am I supposed to be mad at him? Is it weird that we're going out with him? He's taking us to see this rated R Joel Schumacher movie, because I really wanted to see it because the poster sold me.
Yeah.
Anyway, this was your first viewing of Flatliners.
No, keep going. I want to know, like, how did you reconcile all of this?
No, I don't know. I liked Flatliners. Okay.
So, like, you forgot about all the angst for your parents' divorce because you...
For 2 hours. Yeah, it was like I went to the other side. And then...
I was hoping Flatliners cured you of it.
I had saved up a bunch of money and at one point bought a camcorder. And it was like the full... Not the mini tape. It was like the full-size half-inch VHS camcorder.
Okay.
And I could use it as a second VCR. Uh-huh. So I would go to the video store and rent movies and copy everything that I rented. So Flatliners, I think, was the first movie I ever copied also, so I could watch it right after it had come out on video. So I've seen Flatliners a bunch of times, I guess, is where I'm going with this.
Nice. So you're very familiar with the Ballad of Billy Mahoney.
Of course, yeah.
Okay, so Flatliners is exactly the movie that I thought it would be.
Yep.
It's good. It's not, like, great.
It's ridiculous.
It is completely ridiculous.
Right.
It's the type of movie that has a first act and then nothing after that.
But in 1990, it's like, okay, yeah. I see what you did there.
Can I talk to you about 1990 for a second?
Please do.
If I never knew about Flatliners and you put it on and you said, guess what year this movie came out? I would say 1990.
Yeah.
Because, like, it just looks like a movie that came out. It looks exactly like Jacob's Ladder photography. Like, I don't know what was going on in 1990. It's like they got the Technotronic camera or something like that, where everything looks like this, like Flatliners, but that's kind of what it was. The thing that kind of struck me about it was it's a Vincent Price movie. Like, if you think if this was made in, like, the 50s or 60s, it could have very easily been, like, a goofy, silly kind of Vincent Price movie.
Yeah, you're right.
And I liked it from that regard. I thought Kevin Bacon, like, actually gave a good performance in it.
Why do you sound surprised by that?
Because
when
it's
is
a
Kevin
movie.
Bacon not good?
No,
ask
he's
yourself that.
No, he's always good, but he elevates the material much. Because I'm used to seeing Kevin Bacon in material that's more like deserving of his talent, and this is kind of more like, I mean, I haven't seen RIPD. I'm sure he elevates the shit out of that, but this is like not the type of movie that deserves like a fully dimensional performance.
Well, and he's also the most sympathetic character, right?
He is, yeah. He's
him and Julia Roberts, of course.
Of course, she was a pretty woman back then.
She was.
Yeah, I hope she wasn't sleeping with the enemy. But it's okay.
Dying. I'm out.
Oh, God. My stomach hurts. Shouldn't have ate all that Mystic pizza. I'm out. I got nothing else. Okay. Mary Riley. Okay.
I love Trouble.
Yeah. Who doesn't want to see her hook up with Nick Nolte?
Oh.
Adorable. So.
Oh, I thought you were just making a Hook reference.
Oh,
like,
no.
Hook.
No.
It was clever.
Damn it.
Yeah.
I should have. Yeah. I missed my opening there.
Yeah.
So, okay, it's about, like, you die, you go over to the other side, you atone or make peace with what was, like,
well, now you're spoiling what they learn in Flatliners.
If you haven't seen Flatliners since 1990, then, like,
you have had time to catch
up. You've had time to catch up. You're either, like, me, where it's, like, one of the last three movies you haven't seen, that Amadeus and the Last Emperor, or you just were never going to get around to it. So I'm sorry if I spoiled Flatliners for you, then you missed your chance.
You missed your window on Flatliners.
You missed your window. So, okay, so it's... I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Jewish holiday of Yom Kippur.
I mean, I know that it exists.
It's the Day of Atonement.
Right. I've seen Atonement.
I should watch Atonement on Yom Kippur.
Yeah.
So
it's a holiday that celebrates unnecessary tracking shots, right?
Yeah,
okay,
exactly. It's also one of the high holidays, so that's why I watch How High.
Oh, all right. There's one really funny scene in How High. We're so off topic.
I'm taking you off my buddy list, bitch.
I don't even remember that. I saw How High in a theater. That was another, like, five movie day.
Yeah.
No, don't they, like, smoke the ashes of a dead president?
Don't remember.
I think they do, and it's funny.
Cool.
The end.
We should do a podcast on How High.
I thought that's what this podcast was.
Okay, keep going. So, yeah, it's the Jewish Day of Atonement. So Flatliners is basically like the Yom Kippur horror movie. It's interesting, but the thing that I'm confused about is if they do all this stuff up front,
right,
when they really die, what is going to happen with them?
Good point. Well, I guess maybe it'll just... like we never get to see that version, but it won't be the hellish nightmare that this death was.
What if Joel Schumacher did a before sunrise of this,
I like it,
and came back 24 years later, and then they re-died, and then they have new stuff to atone for, and then they kept doing it every 24 years?
Are their lives just hell now because they're so worried about, like, pissing anyone off for the remainder of their lives that, like... it's just torture every day. They just have to hold the door open for every single person they see.
I hope so.
Otherwise, they're going to be haunted by cranky old lady on the street. What happens in Oliver Platt's hell, too? That's something I want to get to the bottom of. We never get to see.
I think it's just that he can't be William Baldwin.
Dreamboat William Baldwin.
Exactly. Yeah. Who, I thought it was really funny because they show, like, this nightmare sequence where he's walking through, like, the parade of women that he's screwed over.
Yeah, it's awful, dude.
It's terrible. It's like, you lose Hope Davis. Like, talk about hopeless. I'd be more like hopeful. But anyways, it's like Demon Night, where, like, Uncle Willie's walking through.
Yeah, right? Yeah,
it's
totally.
Really, it was really weird.
Yeah.
So Flatliners is worth watching. I liked it. I also watched Paranoia.
Yes, you did.
I have to do an upfront about Paranoia. Some people will watch any comic book movie.
Right.
Some people will watch any horror movie.
Right.
I will watch any corporate thriller.
Really?
Yes.
That's fascinating.
I have a weakness for the corporate thriller.
Really?
The more ridiculous, the better.
Well, this seems right up your alley.
I really like Disclosure.
Oh my gosh.
Because that's when virtual reality came to the office. And that's what my life is like every day. So I have to use a TurboGrafx and a Sega Menacer to find my Microsoft Word files. So, okay.
We did not understand technology in the 90s.
No, we didn't.
At all.
Not really, no.
The net was a thing.
I remember it was a big thing in the net where it was like she ordered a pizza. And everybody's like, you could do that online?
Right?
Yeah.
My God.
It was... boss.
Dennis Miller was her friend.
Well, who wouldn't?
I haven't had a pizza that fast since
the Ottoman Empire. I love it.
Yeah, thanks.
I love it. Yeah. Okay, so I knew I was going to like Paranoia because the tagline for Paranoia is, in a war between kings, even a pawn can change the game.
Oh.
Boom. So,
all dang. Right.
So this is a terrible yet wonderful movie. It's the kind of movie that Hayden Christensen would have crushed in 2005.
Yeah.
Like he had, like Liam Hemsworth, who in the movie is the son of Richard Dreyfuss, go figure.
What?
Richard Dreyfuss must have had sex with Helen of Troy for that to happen. Because Liam Hemsworth is an 8, maybe a 9 for sure. But, and Richard Dreyfuss is all like, zoinks. Oh yeah, and by the way, there's a scene in the movie where they show, like, they're getting back to basics, and it's just, like, him reuniting with his father, and they meet up at a Little League baseball game.
What?
And, like, they're watching Little Leaguers play, and it's, like, not any of their nephews or children.
They're just hanging out at the local Little League game.
And then, like, Liam Hemsworth talking to his dad, and he's like, I don't know what to do. Should I talk to the FBI? What should I do? And Dreyfuss is just like, hey, shut up. McNamara's up. And then he's like, that's Carmine Scarpaglia. He used to kick my ass in kindergarten and everything. anyway, so it's a terrible movie. Amber Heard is still trying to figure out how to act.
Yeah,
in it.
She keeps getting cast and
she
stuff,
keeps,
though. So
she's cute.
Good
but
job.
Yeah, good on her.
Yeah.
It's like a poor man's Antitrust.
Oof. Oof.
Corporate thriller. I'm still okay with
Antitrust. I remember watching the trailer, seeing the trailer before a movie, and literally just wondering to myself, who is going to see that movie?
To see Antitrust?
Paranoia.
Oh, Paranoia.
Like, it showed up on Netflix Instant.
Yeah.
And I texted you immediately, and I was like, oh, Paranoia is
on
Netflix.
I was very excited about it.
But, like, who is in a theater who is like, it's Friday, I'm going to a movie, Paranoia's out. I'm in. Is that person? Who is the movie for?
I almost did.
But sort of ironically, right?
Oh, yeah.
Who is the person who's doing it just going straight? Like,
I don't know.
I guess there could be a huge Harrison Ford fan or huge Gary Oldman fan or
Harrison Ford's...
Johnny Depp, maybe. He's got to pay to see his fiance and stuff.
Maybe. Harrison Ford's character's name in this movie is Jock Goddard.
Good Lord.
And Gary Oldman's character is introduced being angry over like his cup of tea.
Of course.
He's yelling at his assistant. He's like, the water should be boiling. And it,
everyone!
It's fan. Oh, God. I love how they keep using that joke on Community this year.
Right?
It's
right.
So great. So in a war between kings, only Adam Riske is the winner. But I really liked it. I know that it's not good, but I had a great time. But it's the type of movie where Liam Hemsworth is so bad at his job that he's like a peon making like below minimum wage and gets fired. But then because it's corporate espionage, he becomes an executive the next weekend.
Yeah.
Because
that's a thing that happens.
Because they said, hey, come over and we'll like put you in a suit.
Right. Yeah. No, that's
that's how that works.
That's
exactly how that happens.
That's like when Paul Walker gets fired from the police force, spends years as a criminal, and then becomes an FBI agent two movies later.
That makes sense.
That's a thing.
Yeah, it does. It is. It is a thing.
What is the best corporate thriller, or what's your favorite corporate thriller ever made?
Like, ironically?
No, like, you really love them, like, what's the best version?
Michael Clayton's really good.
Oh, I love Michael Clayton.
Michael Clayton is really, really good. I'm trying to think. I mean, like, I really like Wall Street.
Okay. How do you feel about Money Sleeping?
Not a fan.
No, that movie's garbage.
It's the Shia problem.
It's not just the Shia problem. That movie has a lot of problems.
Yeah, that's true. And they...
The trailer for that movie was so much better than that movie.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Awesome trailer.
I saw that movie with my dad, and my dad is... He was like a financial accountant.
Okay.
So he was like explaining to me like all this stuff. He's like, well, this was like Goldman Sachs, and this was like this, and... I was just like, are you rationalizing the money? I'm like...
Does he know if money ever sleeps? I mean, he worked with money. Does he know what it does at night?
I don't know. I mean, like, he goes to bed pretty early.
All right. Well, maybe ask him.
I would ask him, but he's probably in bed right now. Daddy sleeps sometimes. I love my dad. He's awesome. Anyways... he didn't take me to see Flatliners, though, because my parents stayed married.
Yeah, married.
It was either you get divorced or you see Flatliners.
You see Flatliners the way it was meant to be seen.
Okay, and then wrapping up, I watched, speaking of Shia, Nymphomaniac, volumes 1 and 2. So it's the story of a girl named Jo, and her inbox is white hot, and... She's a real sex machine. I'm talking morning, day, night, afternoon, dick, 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 dick.
How many dicks is that?
A lot. And she meets this Shia LaBeouf looking motherfucker, and she's like, whoa, baby. And this guy's just like Stanley in Holes. He's digging tunnels. And that's all I got. Hence,
that's good, though.
Like a virgin.
You were on a run for a while there.
Yeah. So.
All right, everybody.
Who
cough
didn't
up your buck.
Who didn't throw in? I thought Eddie Bunker was a star. And then I realized Eddie Bunker wasn't a star.
Just an inmate.
Yeah, apparently. Okay, so what's your take on Lars von Trier?
I haven't seen enough of his movies, honestly. I've seen a handful. I liked Dancer in the Dark. I never want to see it again.
Yeah.
I thought Melancholia was beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't love it.
Mm-hmm.
I thought... Antichrist
was
well made and effective, but also something that I never want to see again.
Right.
So far he's made a lot of movies that I say that works. I never want to see it again.
I'm kind of the same way. Like, I've never rewatched any of his stuff.
Right.
But I feel like I'm this far in with him. I might as well keep going.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that he's an interesting director. Like, I'm happy that he exists, even though it's, because he's just so strange and like just unfiltered, and they almost have like a line of dialogue in the movie where it could double for him like justifying his career. And it's interesting because the Charlotte Gainsborough character says, you know, would you rather have a person who says all the right things but does all the wrong things, or basically have somebody who means well but has no idea how to say anything well. And okay. I feel like that kind of explains Von Trier in a way. Like, I feel like he's coming from a sincere place where he wants to express himself.
Okay.
But he is just so messed up that it just is completely discomforting and weird when he does it.
Right.
So.
But see, I don't think that's a thing that's like lost in translation. I think he's expressing what he wants to express. I just think he's an alien, and so the rest of us react to it weirdly because we're like, oh, I can't believe you think those things,
or exactly
that you would say those things. But I don't think he's someone who means well but doesn't know how to express it. Like, I think he's expressing exactly
what
he wants to say, because he's a very, very talented. I mean, you watch one of his movies and you're like, oh my gosh, this guy is really in command. It's just that what he's saying is so foreign to me.
No, that's a good point. This movie is, for as much sex as in it, it's...
Yeah.
There's... You won't get even, like, a flutter of a boner, like, at any point in
this movie.
There goes
my boner flutter.
I'm sorry. I mean, and it's weird because
boner
it's,
boner flutter is my new favorite expression.
Because it's sex nudes. It's not grief nudes or crisis nudes.
Right,
it's... But, the thing that the movie does well is the volume one is actually pretty funny.
That's what I heard.
In a twisted way, because... Yeah. You have to get on its wavelength, but there's certain things where she's like having sex with so many men in one night that she just has a roll of dice. She just has dice and she rolls it, and that's how she decides whether to keep a guy around or not.
All right.
And it's sort of just funny how blasé she is about it.
Right.
And it's just weird, and like they've got all these things where Charlotte Gainsborough is like the older version of the younger woman that you see throughout most of volume one.
Right, right.
And she's telling these really graphic sex stories to Stellan Skarsgård. And Stellan Skarsgård is a very literate person, but you could tell that he's not... He's just like a guy who reads books all the time.
Right.
So anytime she brings up something about sex, he's just like, oh, you're teasing them, like fly fishing. And like he'll give this analogy about fly fishing, or he'll talk about like some kind of number sequence based on the number of thrusts she says that she got in the butt and stuff like that. And then there's a point in volume two where she just says, of all your digressions, this was the most pointless and stupid. And it's like kind of aware of what it's doing.
Right.
So it's calling him out on being like pretentious and everything, which is funny. And there's certain parts where it's like, it's interesting because they take it where they take it seriously about her being like a nymphomaniac and like all the problems that being one would cause in someone's life. So like in the beginning, when you're like this hot young girl, it's like, oh, well, it's kind of fun. But then like when you're an adult, like you're a mother and things like that, or you can't keep a job because you're like thinking about sex all the time.
I saw Shame. I know what it's like.
Yeah. Shame is rough.
I mean,
rough.
At one point he even has sex with another man. That's how bad it is.
Yeah. And that, no, I was gonna say a joke, but I bit my tongue and I'm happy I did it. I'm super happy I did it.
For the record, mine was a joke as well. Everyone.
Mine was gonna be about 12 Years a Slave, and I backed
off.
Oh
yeah,
and
no, I think you
happy,
made the right call.
And I am happy that I did.
Yeah.
By the way, okay, can we relax on this Lupita Nyong'o thing? Because like everybody's saying how I read this thing in Entertainment Weekly, and they were saying how like casting directors, if they can't figure out what to do with Lupita Nyong'o, then they have failed as an industry. And I'm just like,
that's
all right.
A little...
I'm like, she's good, but like, let's not get out of hand here.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't even judge it based on that one performance, and I haven't seen her work as a flight attendant in Nonstop. But
so good.
And I understand that like she gets up there to give speeches, and she's beautiful, and she has a lot of charisma. Like I could see watching her give her acceptance speech and say, oh wow, she's a star, you know?
Right.
So I understand that they're saying like, yeah, find good roles for her, not like some of the other former Oscar winners who are then marginalized, especially if they are minorities.
I don't know. But it's like any entertainment journalism, everything's taken to like hyperbolic
but take
extreme.
It easy. Right,
yeah,
exactly.
So anyways, just wrapping up, like Nymphomaniac Volumes 1 and 2, I don't know if I would recommend it. If you've been watching Lars von Trier movies, this is better than Antichrist and Manderley, but it's not as good as like Dogville or Melancholia. So it's fine. I don't know if you should invest 4 hours to watch a movie that's fine.
Yeah, right.
But
Yeah. He's one of those guys that I feel like, even though I haven't seen all of his movies, I feel like all of his movies are worth seeing just because he made them.
Yeah.
And there's nobody else really like him, you know? Yeah. So I will see it at some point. I just haven't yet.
Right. So that's what I got. I went on a really long
time.
No,
that's okay. I don't have a ton of new stuff, honestly. I mean, I've rewatched, like, I started trying to do that marathon that I outlined last week, but I wasn't doing it all at once. So, like, one night I rewatched The Phantom, one night I rewatched Punisher Warzone. That's as far as I got. I recommended it last week for Netflix, but I wanted to talk again about Contracted real quickly.
Okay.
I just think it's really good.
Yeah.
Like,
I saw some people were kind of freaked out by it from what the comments.
Yeah, it just presents some kind of disturbing imagery. Like, it's not even that it's super gross or gory necessarily. It just shows you some things and you kind of connect the dots. I mean, definitely felt like old Cronenberg, you know, on purpose, I think. And I'd be curious to hear people's thoughts on the very end, obviously. If you're going to talk about it in the comments, really tag it with a spoiler. But the movie does something at the very end, and I'm wondering if I'm interpreting it correctly or not. But it's on Netflix Instant. I really think you should watch it. The director is this guy, Eric Englund, whose last movie, I think, was called Madison County, and it was a movie I really didn't like. It was just, like, such a super generic sort of Texas Chainsaw, Hills Have Eyes, that kind of a backwoods slasher ripoff. And I just was not a fan, and I thought this one was really, really good. It stuck with me for days. And then I guess the only I've watched garbage lately. The only other thing I'll talk about is How to Lose Friends and Alienate People.
Did you seen it before?
No.
I rented it and turned it off.
And I don't blame you because your life is no worse for it.
Okay.
Again, I just have that thing where, like, oh, I'm going to finish this.
Yeah.
Came out a couple years ago, bombed in a big way.
Yeah.
Just showed up on Netflix, and I liked the cast enough. It's Simon Pegg and Jeff Bridges and Kirsten Dunst and Megan Fox, who, you know, I can take or leave, but mostly leave. But I like those three enough that I thought I would give it a shot. And it's just, it's this bizarre, it's based on, like, a memoir by Toby Young, I think is his name. And I don't know anything about him except that he's brash and British. And he was, like, a judge on Top Chef when Erica and I watched it for a couple seasons, and he was a judge, and I remember him being just the worst. Like, he would try and script out his criticisms, and they were so obnoxious, and he was so full of himself. So Simon Pegg sort of plays a version of him, and it's this movie that, like, it wants to say something about celebrity, it wants to say something about journalism, but then, like, he'll accidentally kill Megan Fox's dog and it's supposed to be funny, or, like, Kirsten Dunst throws up in his car and it's supposed to be funny. And how many movies are we going to see where Kirsten Dunst is, like, the girl that the guy just can't see because he's too focused on the other prettier girl? And then eventually, I mean, it turns into such this stupid standard romantic comedy where, like, he has to get on a plane and go tell someone he loves them. And
really have him go on, get on a plane?
Yes. Yeah. It's a crazy schizophrenic movie. At one point, Danny Houston is in the movie. He's so much more talented than this movie.
Okay.
But there's a scene where Danny Houston, who's sort of the villain, he's the one of the guys that works at the magazine, and he has to tell Simon Pegg, like, stop sexually harassing women at the water cooler. And we're supposed to read the scene as, like, oh, what an asshole, because he's also being a hypocrite because he does it too. And he says, when I do it, it's flirting. But, like, we're supposed to read the scene like he's this big asshole for telling our hero to stop harassing women at the water cooler. But it's like, no, stop sexually harassing me. Why is that? That's not a villainous thing to say. You should stop sexually harassing your coworkers.
And we learned from SNL that unless you look like Tom Brady, you can't do that.
Exactly. It's really not good. And it's weird to see a movie with talented people involved.
Do so poorly. It just kind of shows you how important writers are like the right director, especially with comedy.
It only tries to be funny sort of sporadically. It's like they'll realize, oh, we haven't had a joke for 20 minutes. Someone throw up.
You know? It's like what year did it come out? Like 2009?
That would be my guess, yeah.
It's like 2009's version of Delivery Man.
I have not seen Delivery Man, but sure.
It was playing on my airplane on the way home.
That does seem like an airplane movie.
I wanted to take my, like, my earphones and wrap them around my neck. No, I like would glance up every once in a while. Yeah. And then
he was
changing
those kids' lives.
He was. And I would see like Colby Smulders on the screen. Eesh. And then like, then they played a bunch of like NBC shows, including like Celebrity Game Night, and Colby Smulders was there. And I'm like, what is this? The Colby Smulders flight?
It was an all Smulders flight.
Yeah, it was Smulder.
Her episode of, was she on Avengers? I don't know. Or not Avengers, S.H.I.E.L.D.
Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I bailed on that show about halfway through episode one.
Yeah, I'm kind of glad that it failed.
I don't know that it has, actually. I mean,
creatively, it sounds like from everybody else.
Yeah, I don't think a ton of people love it, but it may get renewed. I'm sure it's super expensive, so I don't know.
I mean, like, I just want one thing Marvel to fail.
It's going to happen eventually.
Yeah.
It hasn't quite happened yet.
I'm not rooting for things to fail except for Marvel.
Yeah.
And
well,
that's it.
Well, this is obviously a totally different conversation, but
yeah.
There is a little bit of a manufactured glow on the studio right now because I'm a fan of what they're doing. I think they're doing things in a smart way, but
yeah.
But I also think when something like Thor: The Dark World comes out, we need to be able to say like that's not that good, guys, instead of just praising it because it's Marvel. Which I mean,
and I think it got that a little bit.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah.
If people like it, it's because they like it. It's not just because it's Marvel. But
see, I'm not crazy about Marvel, but like I was entertained by Thor: The Dark World more than the first Thor, at least. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
But anyways,
I'm still excited about Captain America.
I am too.
Let's talk about that other movie that we're going to talk about.
Oh yeah, we were going to talk about
Flatliners. I believe it
was
the best exotic marigold hotel.
That's right. There, it was the one about a hotel with Tom Wilkinson. So it was definitely the best exotic marigold hotel.
This is the one about the hotel for dogs.
Yeah, it's in Rwanda.
What's that called again?
Hotel Rwanda
for dogs.
For
hotel
dogs.
Rwanda for dogs.
Yeah.
All right, so we're going to talk about the Grand Budapest Hotel.
That movie's rough.
Oh, Jesus.
I'm sorry.
We're going to talk spoiler-free for most of the conversation. I will let you begin because you had suggested this show.
I did. So the reason why I suggested the show is not a super interesting reason, but I just think that it's fun to talk about movies with directors who kind of matter.
Okay.
So I feel like Wes Anderson... It kind of ties into something that I was thinking. First time I thought it was with This Is 40 with Judd Apatow, where I'm not a big fan of This Is 40, but at the same time, after I leave it, I'm thankful that it's a movie made by Judd Apatow, just like I'm thankful that Grand Budapest Hotel is a movie made by somebody who's trying.
I think I understand what you're saying.
So I'll go on until you understand, because that's the goal, is understanding. So like even if it's bad, it's interesting because you can kind of try to figure out how it fits into their career and
Absolutely.
Like where they're going and like what they're, if they're growing or if they're not or regressing and like what kind of makes them tick. And I felt that way with Grand Budapest Hotel. It's funny because you and I think, have different paths with our fandom on Wes Anderson, because I don't want to speak for you, but I think that you liked him more in the beginning than you do in later career.
Yes.
And he took a lot of warming up for me.
Okay.
And then it didn't click until Fantastic Mr. Fox for me.
Okay.
And then I loved Moonrise Kingdom. It was like my second favorite movie the year it came out.
Behind what?
Silver Linings Playbook.
Oh, that's right.
And then I liked Grand Budapest Hotel not as much as Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Interesting.
And Moonrise Kingdom, but I did like it. I went back and watched all of the Wes Anderson stuff before Grand Budapest, and I have a new appreciation for Royal Tenenbaums and Rushmore and somewhat Life Aquatic than I didn't before, but I still don't really like Bottle Rocket or Darjeeling. Okay. They don't really work for me. I think Darjeeling's probably like the low point for me for his career.
Yeah, I would probably agree with that, even though I don't necessarily like Life Aquatic all that much still, and I know people love it. But to me, it's kind of what you were talking about, where like, even where I think it fails, at least it sort of fails in an interesting way within his body of work.
Yeah.
And it is trying to do some different things. And so I don't mind it being a part of his filmography. Darjeeling Limited to me feels like him on repeat.
Yes.
And so that's why I like it less, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that with Darjeeling, it was more just because I think there was like too much Adrian Brody going on.
Perhaps.
Too much like Owen Wilson going on. There just wasn't like, because usually he's got these big ensembles, and
right.
I felt like that one was, you had to really like those actors in order to kind of,
which in a way, and we're getting way off track, but I'll bring it back to Grand Budapest Hotel in one second. In a way, I thought that was almost okay, only because he had done ensemble for a couple movies in a row. So I was like, okay, great, bring it back to of just a few characters, and maybe it will be different in that way. But instead, it was like, we have daddy issues and vintage clothes.
Yeah.
So Grand Budapest Hotel, I feel like, gets back to that ensemble thing almost to its detriment.
I would agree with that.
Because it does that thing where every couple minutes it's like, oh, and here's this actor and here's this actor. And in some ways it's great because it's all people you like to see for the most part. And so it's fun to see everybody show up, but it does become a little bit distracting. Even though it's very much about, you know, and I'm being a hypocrite because a few weeks ago I watched Knight Riders for the first time.
Yeah.
And all of Romero's company shows up in that movie. And that's part of the fun of that movie.
Yeah.
And that's sort of true of Grand Budapest Hotel as well. It's like, here's Wes Anderson's company and they all show up in these little parts. So while I think it had the potential to be distracting, for me it wasn't so bad because I was like, oh, and they're so-and-so, and you're in the company too.
Yeah, there's some, I would agree with that. There's some people, though, where I felt like Bill Murray was there and like Owen Wilson was there, like through that sequence with the
crossed keys.
Just because they wanted to find a way to get them in there.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
And that's a little distracting, and like more so than in some of his other movies. And I don't think this would matter to, like, just a more casual movie-going audience. But when I see, like, Lea Seydoux in it, but she's doing nothing.
Right.
Or, like,
she didn't eat one plate of spaghetti.
She did it. They ate a lot of spaghetti in that movie.
Oh, my gosh. In real time. Always in real time.
Yeah. Well, Barilla. What are you going to do? It was just kind of distracting for me because I almost wish, like, Harvey Keitel was played by somebody I didn't know.
Right, sure.
Because it's just takes you out of the story a little bit because for a few seconds you're like, oh, you know, like, how is he going to be different than he was in Moonrise Kingdom? What's his little arc here?
Right.
But that's, I mean, like, maybe a good place to start just because it's such an actor's movie is, like, what performances would you say that you like the most?
I wish I had my phone or some sort of smart. Do you have the name of the actor that played Omar?
From The Wire?
Not Omar, Zero. Sorry.
Oh, Zero.
Yeah, I don't know why I called him Omar.
Tony Revolari.
Tony Revolari. Okay. He was great.
Yes.
In that way that Wes Anderson is really good with particularly kid actors. I mean, the two kids in Moonrise Kingdom, I remember saying over and over again that those kids are so good.
Yeah.
In a way that can't be taught, like it's sort of by accident, and he's good at spotting the kid who's going to give an unaffected performance.
Yes.
And maybe it's because the style of the dialogue that he writes just sounds a certain way coming out of the mouth of a kid who's almost too young to speak that way or deliver it. So their disconnect there is charming, but I thought he was good in the way that those kids in Moonrise Kingdom were good.
Yeah.
I thought Ralph Fiennes was the show. I mean,
oh yeah. Yeah. He was really good. I was struggling before I looked it up to remember if he's done much comedy.
As soon as it started, I was like, oh wow. This, because I knew nothing about the movie. I don't even think I'd watched a trailer, and this speaks to a bigger thing that's going on with me these days where I'm avoiding more and more marketing going into a movie. I'll see trailers before movies. I'm not one of these people that like runs out until the trailers are over because I like trailers. I won't watch them online and that kind of stuff. So I knew nothing about the movie. And even when the TV spots would come on, I would actually fast forward them if I was watching something DVR'd because I was sort of dreading this movie.
Yeah. I remember last week you said that you were kind of irritated by the preview.
Yeah.
And I was wondering like what in particular that was?
I felt like I had reached a breaking point with Wes Anderson, and I don't know what it is, because I liked Moonrise Kingdom enough. I didn't love it. I liked the stuff with the kids a lot. I thought some of the stuff with the adults I wasn't as crazy about. I thought the last act I didn't love. And truth be told, I haven't seen the movie since the theater, so maybe if I would watch it again, I would like it more. I like his first three movies. I genuinely love Royal Tenenbaums a lot.
Yep.
And then I just felt like he was making the same movie over and over again. And the more that happened, the more I felt like I could probably never see another Wes Anderson movie and be okay.
Okay.
And something about just how self-consciously art-directed they were and how precious every little thing is was really irritating me. And I was trying so hard to clear my mind of that because I wanted to give the movie a fair shake.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to go into it with this shitty attitude like, fuck you, Wes Anderson, you have something to prove, because that's not fair.
Yeah.
And everybody has those filmmakers. People just have, you know, when I hear somebody talk about how much they can't stand De Palma, I'm just like, I don't understand. Everything he does, I find great, and I'm excited by it.
Mm-hmm.
Or Tarantino or whatever. And people have those filmmakers that just for whatever reason rub them the wrong way. Wes Anderson was becoming one of those guys for me, and I didn't, you know, necessarily want him to, but I just felt like, oh my gosh, it's always the same. So I would see stills, or like I would fast forward through the trailer on the DVR, and it was making me upset, and I didn't want it to.
Yeah.
So sitting down to watch the movie, I really was trying to be in a better place and not be irritated by it.
Mm-hmm.
And it the feelings went away pretty quickly. I mean, the movie won me over fairly quickly.
Oh, good.
And I liked it. I liked it a lot. As soon as it ended, I was ready to say that it was like my favorite of his movies since Tenenbaums.
Okay.
I don't know that I still feel that way because I've kind of forgotten parts of it already.
Yeah, I saw it about a week ago.
Yeah, and I just saw it like 2 days ago. I'm saying for the sake of the listeners. I saw it like 2 days ago and I've already forgotten parts of it.
It's funny because I was kind of nervous before going, not, well, that's the wrong word because I'm not nervous like doing a podcast, because that's, why would I be nervous doing a podcast? But I thought I was going to forget a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And it's not that the movie isn't memorable. It's just that it's not something that really kind of stayed with me much afterwards. And when I started to think about it more, I think I came up with things that I wasn't necessarily considering when I was watching it.
Okay.
And I might be, and I'll save that for a little bit later, but I think I might be overanalyzing it a bit, but I've got some kind of theories about the movie. But that being said, I think that I'm starting to get to the point where, especially after Fantastic Mr. Fox and Moonrise Kingdom, and like how Wes Anderson has imparted his style onto a movie like Grand Budapest, he's kind of turning into like the anti-Tim Burton.
Okay.
Where he's primarily a stylist, but he's also a really good storyteller.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Tim Burton never has really been a great storyteller.
No.
Consistently.
Right.
And with Wes Anderson, I feel like this is, and it's not as good, but this is kind of like his, it's like his, if you're doing like an ACT question of like Tarantino is to Anderson as Inglourious Bastards is to Grand Budapest Hotel.
Yeah.
That's kind of how I feel about Grand Budapest Hotel.
I can see that.
I feel like he's taking his style, and a lot of it I think he kind of picked up from Roald Dahl and from like the visual stuff that he learned through the animation in Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Yeah, there's a lot of that in the movie.
Yeah, and it provides some of like the best visual jokes,
yeah,
for sure. Especially that ski chase,
which is great,
is phenomenal,
yeah.
And it's something straight out of Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Right.
I think that he's taking this almost like childlike point of view,
right,
to adult material, and it makes it more poignant in a way.
Okay.
So, for example, like with Moonrise Kingdom, the thing that I love about that movie so much, and the reason why it connected with me as much as it did, is because it's basically these two misfit kids, and it's all these adults basically trying to destroy their happiness.
Right.
And it's because of their own baggage, and it's like we need to protect Like, if you can't even let them make their own mistakes and, like, protect their, like, innocence, then, like, what are we doing?
Right.
And I felt like that was kind of, like, what he's doing with Grand Budapest Hotel, because you've got this kind of cute story about a guy who really loves what he does, and he doesn't maliciously, like, sleep with older women. He just genuinely enjoys their company, and, like, he wants to make people happy, and you have this lobby boy who really wants to be good at his job, and he, you know, is in love with a baker and everything like that, and you've got this sweet story, and then it becomes this caper where it's you know, like something out of like a Murder on the Orient Express or like an Agatha Christie thing, but it's fun. But all around it is basically Nazi Germany,
right?
And like fascism, and that stuff is always encroaching on right. the propriety and the good feelings of the European culture that's going on there. So it's kind of like a revisionist version in certain ways, that like the same way that of history that like Inglourious Basterds was, where they were using like genre material to kind of comment on
right.
what was going on at the time of during like pre-World War II and World War II. And I think that, like I said earlier, I mean, like, it adds a lot of poignancy to the movie, and it makes it, this is by far, I think, Wes Anderson's saddest movie.
Interesting.
I thought it was definitely his saddest. I thought it was his most suspenseful, for sure.
Okay.
There's a lot of violence in it that is very jarring, and yeah. I think it's done to a point, because the violence of that period, and like the violence of the attitudes of that period, of like this fascism and totalitarianism, were so just kind of like matter of fact.
Okay.
And I was wondering, there's certain things that are kind of like out of place, it seems, unless it fits into this kind of Nazi theme. Like, for example, like you got the little boy at the beginning of the movie who's shooting a cap gun over at Tom Wilkinson.
Right.
And like, it's funny, it's a joke. But at the same time, like I was thinking later, I'm just like, well, maybe that's like somebody being shot like they would like in the Holocaust. I mean, like, because it took me back, and this is kind of a digression, but like it took me back to like when I was in, all right, one of the dumbest things that like the Jewish Community Center has ever done is Holocaust reenactments. So it's, you could like feel like you were there.
Yikes.
Yeah, yikes is right. But they had like these cap guns, and like anytime you talked out a turn, they would shoot you with a cap gun. And it's like, thanks, Mom and Dad, for putting me here in the Hyatt in fucking Schaumburg so I could get shot by a Jew trying to play a Nazi.
Yeah, but now you know what it was like.
Now I know what it was like, clearly. But that's what it reminded me of when I heard like the cap gun thing. And it's so specific to like this weird experience that I had. But I was just kind of like, well, maybe that's why like Tom Wilkinson is just like, stop that. Or maybe it's just because he's being interrupted. I might like I owned up to it at the beginning. I'm probably overanalyzing this to a crazy degree, but I just think that like there's a lot of weird shit with like how awful some of the violence is. Like,
well, let's I have like 10 things that I want to say. It's interesting that you say you think it's his saddest movie, because when it was over, I saw it with my wife, and she turned to me and said that for some reason she didn't, but she was so close to just like bawling.
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, that's weird. I understand some of the sadness, but I think all of his movies have, I think Rushmore does, Tenenbaums does, Darjeeling certainly does, Life Aquatic certainly does, Fantastic Mr. Fox not so much. I think Moonrise Kingdom, I think they all have a heavy element of sadness, particularly in the end.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think I understand sort of where you're coming from, but it surprises me to hear you say it's the saddest. The violence I want to come back to, because I agree with you, it's jarring. And one of the things that I actually really liked about the movie was the way that it sort of contradicts Ralph Fiennes. I got so off topic that I forgot to talk about how much I loved his performance and how he hasn't really done comedy, to your point, because as soon as I realized this was a comedy, because I wasn't even sure going in, I was like, this is really exciting. He never does comedy.
Yeah.
The only other one I can think of is like Made in Manhattan, and I'm not sure that's a comedy.
I thought In Bruges, maybe.
Yeah, I guess. Kind of, yeah.
But that was about
I forgot
it.
That he was in it, honestly.
Yeah.
He's really, really funny, and his character is probably my favorite Wes Anderson creation since Royal Tenenbaum, who we did a thing last weekend where we talked about who's your favorite movie character, and mine is still Marge Gunderson, but yep. Royal Tenenbaum would be in the conversation. I yep. think that is such a great character, and Gene Hackman is so good in that movie. Mm-hmm. But Ralph Fiennes in this movie, I think, is his best creation since Royal Tenenbaum. He's just very funny, and I love the contradiction of his sort of erudite, sophisticated take on the world, but then he's also like really vulgar, and this is like Wes Anderson's kind of dirtiest movie.
Yeah, I love the line where he's just like, I'm not going to fucking Lutz.
Yeah, right. And you know right off the bat, because everybody's talking in this very specific way, and then it just cuts to Jason Schwartzman, and he just goes, shit, like that, and he runs out of the frame, and it's like, oh, that's jarring, because I'm just not used to hearing his characters swear this much, and they do.
Yeah.
But the violence thing I want to come back to, because it is brutal sometimes, and then other times it's kind of played for laughs, and I feel it's weird that the movie is a little bit trying to have it both ways, but I want to talk about why that is later. I want to ask you a question, though, because you brought up the Nazi Germany comparison. The movie is kind of an alternate history where countries are kind of made up, and a lot of the countries and names and like a lot of those things are kind of funny, but the later it gets into the movie where the Nazis are basically starting to occupy places, including the hotel. I hope that's not a spoiler. Their banners are plastered all over the place.
Yes.
And they're not swastikas. They're like cute Wes Anderson versions of swastikas where they're just like black flags with these pink kind of, or were they pink flags with black zags? I can't remember.
I don't remember.
They're black and pink, and they're just like these little zags. And I wanted to get your take on that, because I feel like I had a little bit of a problem with Wes Anderson sort of whitewashing history to match his quirky aesthetic. Like, if you want to make a movie about Nazi Germany, then I feel like you need to use the swastika. That's a symbol that has, that carries with it power and horror appropriately.
Yeah.
And to turn it into this one more of your sort of adorable quirky things, I felt like was a little disingenuous, and maybe I'm overreacting.
I don't think that you're overreacting. I'm the guy who got offended at Nonstop. I mean, like, what
but that's because you felt like casting directors had failed by not using Lupita correctly.
Exactly. No, I mean, like, what offends you. It's like, what, it's subjective. So I didn't find it offensive. I think it's actually an interesting move. I'd say it's actually maybe a good move, because the swastika has so much baggage to it that
but he's using it
here's the thing, though,
in the correct context. I mean, that baggage is appropriate.
Yes, but here's the thing. Okay, so like everything else is not it's off realistic. It's just like 1 degree off of realistic. Right. So I think that you not knowing that until like later on that, oh, this is Nazis, but basically not explicitly Nazis. Right. Like Edward Norton is not a police officer. He's a Nazi stooge.
Right.
Is more effective, because it's something that takes you by surprise. And it's something that, I got two things to kind of say about it is, it's kind of similar into the way that Nazi culture kind of took over Europe. Right. I mean, like, it just kind of encroached itself, and like it made itself insidious in this and just spread. And also, I read that I think at the end, like, there's a credit and it says it's dedicated to Stefan Zweig.
Okay.
So I looked him up, and Stefan Zweig was an author, and he was a pacifist, and he ended up committing suicide like during World War II. And the reason why he did was because he was fleeing Europe to avoid oppression. He was a Jew. And he was depressed by like all the authoritarianism and intolerance that was going on. And he just completely despaired for Europe and what the Nazis were doing to culture. And I feel like that is sort of what Wes Anderson's endgame is here. So I feel like if you put a Nazi swastika in there, you have the book thief. You're already putting yourself in the Holocaust game. And okay. I don't think that the Grand Budapest Hotel is that. I think it's more in the Inglourious Basterds one, okay. where Tarantino is a more daring director. And I think that, and he doesn't pull any punches. And I think that Wes Anderson is still kind of trying to appease a little bit and be like more crowd friendly.
Should we call Wes Anderson the appeaser?
Absolutely.
I was going to make a case that like wouldn't using the actual swastika make it even more sort of jarring and powerful when we get to that moment where it's like, oh, we're in fun Wes Anderson land.
Well,
and
it
how
happened
here's...
late in the movie. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and so here's the real swastika. And it's like, oh, shit just got real. But I think you make an interesting argument that like he's trying to keep it almost as a not as a metaphor, but like as like a children's book version of what happened, sort of.
Yeah.
And I could see that working. So
yeah, I think it would work either way. It's one of those things where the movie is it's not a movie that I love, but it's a movie that I like a lot and I admire a lot.
Yeah.
And I think that there's so much good in it that a choice like that, it's not like going to make or break it one way or the other.
Yeah, I just, something about it rubbed me the wrong way because you're talking about one of the most violent, awful images in our history. And I felt like to co-opt it and to sort of turn it into your cutesy Wes Anderson thing was wrong. But I understand sort of, you know, after you talk about it, like, yeah, I could see that there's a reason for it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering how much of my reaction to the movie too, and I did, like you, I liked it a real lot. How much of that is a reaction to how much I thought I might not like it because I was so tired of Wes Anderson that it became such a pleasant surprise. I definitely think it's his best plotted movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think Fantastic Mr. Fox has a lot of that too. I'm not as big a fan of Fantastic Mr. Fox as everyone. To me, it's a movie that just, it's beautiful, and I love the ingenuity and the animation and all that, but it just stays on the screen for me.
I think that was the movie that kind of hooked me onto Wes Anderson just because...
Well, it's perfectly suited for what he does.
I was so... I just thought it was so funny.
Yeah.
I hadn't... there are certain elements of like Rushmore and Royal Tenenbaums where I laughed really hard.
Yeah.
But Fantastic Mr. Fox was weird. I think it caught me off guard.
Sure.
Because I was kind of in the same boat as you were with Grand Budapest, where I was almost like actively avoiding it. And then I just saw it and I ended up liking it a lot more than I thought that I would. One actor in it, and this might just be because I don't like him as an actor.
Okay.
But I thought that Adrian Brody was pretty bad in the movie. I think that everything that Ralph Fiennes does well, with comedic swearing, Adrian Brody is terrible at.
I guess his performance didn't affect me one way or the other because I felt like he was costumed so funny and his hair and mustache were so funny that I felt like when he was on screen, his work was done. Like, that's the joke.
Well, according to that Razor commercial, he's one of like the three leading stylists in America.
His performance was almost, it didn't matter to me because he's not called upon to do very much.
Yeah.
And so I felt like just seeing him was funny. I think Willem Dafoe does the same thing better because seeing Willem Dafoe is way funnier
is so fucking great.
He really is.
He's amazing.
Yeah, he's great in the movie.
You know who else I'm really starting to get an appreciation for over the years? Is Jeff Goldblum.
How did you not have an appreciation of Dr. Ian Malcolm?
All right, here's the thing. So I like Dr. Ian Malcolm, of course, but when I was younger, I didn't like Dustin Hoffman, and then I turned the corner on Dustin Hoffman because
I'm still waiting to
because
do that.
I'm just like, you know, you it's like you say tomato, I say tomato, you say The Graduate, I say Mad City. That's kind of like how it was for a while. And then Michael Keaton was another one because I was like all up in like Multiplicity and like Desperate Measures. I just got to him at the wrong time.
Yeah.
And like Batman.
And now you see him in Need for Speed and you're like, that guy's got it.
That's the worst performance he's given in a long time.
What are you talking about?
It's an anomaly.
His inbox is white hot.
His inbox is white hot. He's like Joe from Nymphomaniac. there's a scene in Nymphomaniac where she just shoves spoons up her cha-cha-cha.
Yeah. And that's Udo, what people do.
And Udo Kier is in that scene, and somehow it's just like, perfect, Udo Kier has to be in this scene.
Anytime anyone shoves a spoon into their vagina, Udo Kier is there.
He's like the
It's like his bat signal.
He's like the German less talented Peter Lorre.
He hears it go in, and he just appears like Beetlejuice.
Yeah, he is. There's just something about Jeff Goldblum. I just like hearing him talk.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Just like his diction is just amazing.
He doesn't deliver lines like anybody else would. I mean, Christopher Walken has a little bit of that, but it's become such self-parody at this point.
Yeah.
But yeah, anytime Goldblum shows up, you know it's going to be interesting.
Exactly.
Always.
Exactly.
Even in Vibes, it's going to be interesting.
Yeah.
No, it was great to see him in this.
Yeah, he's so good. Because he's good in Life Aquatic, too. But I mean, like, he's on, like, another level in this. He's just so enjoyable.
Yeah.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. Like, Fiennes is really the whole show.
Oh, man. He's so great.
He's so great in
it. He's really... I really... The movie's a lot of fun, and I appreciated the fact that I was enjoying it just as this wacky sort of caper movie, as you described it. And it honestly wasn't until the last lines of the movie, which I won't talk about yet until we get into spoilers, where what it's all about really came into focus for me. And maybe that's just lazy viewing on my part because I was just watching it for plot instead of theme.
Sure.
But then once it came into focus, I sort of rethought the entire movie as being a metaphor for something else, and I really liked it that much more. Again, coming out of it, I was positive that this was his best thing since Tenenbaums, and maybe it's not. I don't know. And you know, he's a filmmaker where it's like he's got four different movies that it's like the, I know you don't love the Coen brothers, but you know, people can name four or five different Coen brothers movies as their favorite.
I'm starting to turn around on him.
Just a little bit. Everybody could have a different favorite, and you would say, "Yeah, I understand." Or Tarantino, and there's a lot of directors like that.
Yeah.
And I Wes Anderson is one. You know, you could tell me that your favorite is, as long as you don't say it's Darjeeling, I get it.
Right.
Yeah, I thought it was great.
Cool. Spoilers?
Gosh, already? I guess we could. I mean, we've been talking for a while. I feel bad. I think I will say this. If you are somebody who has been left cold by Wes Anderson, I think you can go see this movie and really enjoy it.
Mm.
I think it has a lot of his quirks on display. I think it's, you know, art directed just like all of his other movies. And for reasons we'll talk about in spoilers, I think it's maybe his most personal movie. Having said that, I also think he's doing something different. It's not just a movie about sort of rich kids abandoned by their parents who feel, you know, a great sense of melancholy. He's applying his style and making a different kind of movie, and that was exciting to me.
He's sad, like he's still got that sadness, but it's to something that's more expansive,
and again it's a much more plot driven movie. It's a period movie. I mean, there's all these other things that he's attempting to do within his little universe that I think it makes it more accessible than just if he had made another Darjeeling, you know.
What do you think about the tricks with the aspect ratio changing? Do you think it was necessary? Or?
I kind of don't.
I don't think it was necessary at all, but like I'm not, it didn't bother me.
It didn't bother me because I understand the purpose of it. Like I understand that all the Academy ratio or 1:3:3 stuff is more so that he could show off sort of the heights of the hotel, that it's much more of a vertical movie than a horizontal one. I just don't know that it totally had to switch to that wide 2:3:5 for the Jude Law stuff.
Right.
But at the same time, I know that, and self-consciously so, each of those periods, like the style that he's using is sort of reflecting the style of the period. So when you get to the stuff that's in the 60s, right, that's the Jude Law stuff.
Yes.
It looks like a movie out of the 60s, you know?
Yeah. God, I really love the art direction in it. Like all the stuff with the hotel, the exteriors, it just reminded me of like Monty Python.
Yeah, I loved all the stop motion.
And like the ski chase and like the lifts and everything. It's just, oh God.
And I, for the first time in a while, I found myself being sort of delighted by it instead of irritated by it.
Yeah, I just feel like he learned a lot from like what he put into Fantastic Mr. Fox.
I agree. And as somebody who likes but doesn't love Fantastic Mr. Fox,
yeah,
that's great because it's like, oh, he took all the things that I liked from that movie and he applied them to a movie I like much more. Yeah. So this is great.
Yeah, definitely.
He's improving in the right direction. Mm-hmm. Okay, I guess we will talk spoilers now.
Cool.
Let's talk real quick about just the framing structure.
Yes, the nesting doll.
Yeah. Why?
That's a good question. I was giving it some thought. The only thing I could come up with, and I don't know if I agree with it or if I'm just trying to find an answer and kind of put it to bed, is the way that you can make something feel less awful by telephoning it.
Okay.
Story. So, for example, I think that Zero's story is actually even sadder than it's told from F. Murray Abraham to Jude Law. Jude Law took the elements of F. Murray Abraham's story and repurposed it for this book, which, based on like what the cover of this book looked like it was kind of a Roald Dahl type of book. More whimsical than the actual life events. And then I think that kind of expanding it onto that to like the girl reading it, it's interesting just because of like how diluted the story, because if you remember, like, she's putting a key on a bust of the author,
right?
So she's honoring like somebody who's like at least one or two people removed from whose real story this is.
Right.
So it's kind of like a weird thing. Like, if anything, like that bust, which I'm presuming was like the grounds for where the hotel used to be.
I assumed so just because of the hanging of the keys there. But
yeah. That should be like where he finds a bust of him. So, I mean, like, that's the only thing I could come up with the nesting doll, was just, it had something to do with storytelling and how the actual story kind of gets diluted as it keeps getting told. But I don't know how that really fits in with the other themes of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily either, because I don't feel like a lot of his movies are about storytelling, even though just from a purely like motif standpoint, Wes Anderson just loves to have characters writing books or reading from books or books, you know, that are... Mm-hmm. So that shows up in a lot of his movies. So I understand sort of that aspect of it. And driving home, I was saying, you know, I could understand the F. Murray Abraham, Jude Law stuff, just one person telling the story to another. And interesting that he skips over the really sad stuff. I mean, it just brushes right by it at the end. So I understand that, and it gets you to F. Murray Abraham narrating the movie, and he's got a great voice, so that's fine. And so then I started to say, well, I don't even understand why the Tom Wilkinson level, much less, it's like Sucker Punch, much less the girl reading the book. But then as I was saying it, I sort of came up with an idea about the Tom Wilkinson level.
Mm-hmm.
I still can't rationalize the girl reading the book, but let me talk about the Tom Wilkinson level for a sec, because at the end of the movie, again, it kind of comes into focus for me what I think the whole movie is about. And I think the whole movie is about Wes Anderson. Mm-hmm. I think Wes Anderson is the Ralph Fiennes character. I think he fancies himself as a man born of the wrong time.
Okay.
Who, he's not saying he's not appreciated in his time, but a big deal is made at the end that Ralph Fiennes was outdated when he was born. Mm-hmm. The world had passed him by when he was born. And he was trying to live a life and create a world the way that he wanted it to be, but that just doesn't exist anymore. And that's what Wes Anderson has been doing in every movie.
Yeah.
And so I thought, and so that's sort of why I think it's, you know, maybe his most personal movie in that way. And why I think it's okay to have so many of then his stock company show up, because if the movie is about him, it makes sense that, you know, these people are showing up. And that's sort of where the sadness comes in, that we don't appreciate these people, or we don't respect them enough in their day. And Tom Wilkinson's last line in the movie, or is it Jude Law's? It's Tom Wilkinson, right?
I can't remember.
Who says at the end of the movie, like, it was a great hotel or whatever. but I never went back. I never did manage to go back there
or
something.
Yeah.
And I think it's the Tom Wilkinson level. And so to me, that sort of is in keeping with the whole theme of the movie, which is like, here you have a guy who wrote the book on this place, basically. He's the one who was told the story. He wrote the book about this whole thing. And even he never bothered to go back. And that's why these things deteriorate. And that's why these things crumble. Because even the people who are telling the stories are the people who claim to care or the people who should care aren't keeping that tradition alive.
That's really interesting. I didn't think about that. I mean, like, it ties into the whole kind of thing about not honoring culture and how it's really kind of dependent on the people who appreciate it to keep it alive.
Right.
I mean, anybody knows, like, even like something that I make fun of, like the Portage Theater, I'm sad that it's gone.
Yeah.
I mean, like, it was my dump. It was a dump, but it was my dump. And, it's the type of thing where, like, you really just kick yourself when, like, you can't go there anymore because you wish, like, you went to that hotel or that theater or whatever more just to have that one more experience there. I don't know. I mean, like, that gives me a lot to think about. Yeah.
I said we would go back to the violence.
Sure.
So let's go back to the violence.
So, to tie into that, okay, like, one thing that was kind of interesting to me was like how inconsequential kind of like figuring out who killed Tilda Swinton was. Cause I don't think you ever really found out. It's assumed it's probably Defoe.
Right.
Yeah. But like that part is just like so inconsequential.
Right.
And, but there's certain like elements with the violence where the one that really there's two that really stuck with me.
Yes. I'm sure they're the same two as me.
I don't know if it's the second one would be.
Okay.
The first one is definitely the fingers.
Yes.
The finger thing is something that it's almost scary, like out of like Texas Chainsaw, like when like Leatherface slams the steel grate and you know that guy's just doomed.
Right.
I mean, like, it's just so unexpected and just jarring and graphic and just visceral.
And yet at the same time, it's sort of, I feel like, played for a laugh.
Well,
but not really.
With the fingerprints and stuff, how he's missing four fingers.
Right, and maybe I'm just reacting to
the
shock causing an uncomfortable laugh, because I think it did in my theater, because you don't know how else to process it, because you're just not in that mindset when that happens.
Yeah.
You don't expect that in this movie.
Right.
Because it is really brutal and really graphic, and it's like, holy shit. And so maybe it's not fair for me to place the audience reaction on Wes Anderson's intentions, because maybe it's not supposed to be a laugh. Maybe it's just people laughing out of shock.
Yeah.
Like the cat thing I thought was definitely played as a laugh, even though...
Was that the second thing?
No.
Okay, all right. That's...
The second thing to me was during the jailbreak.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about the jailbreak.
It was with those two guys stabbing each other.
Yeah.
And it's really...
Yeah.
Rough. It's horrible to see. You know, I always go back to the worst thing I've seen in a movie. It's maybe not the worst thing I've seen in a movie, but the thing that's maybe the hardest ever to watch for me in a movie is the Adam Goldberg scene in Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah.
I cannot watch that scene. I can't do it. It's awful. And it conjured up memories of that.
Just
how graphic the stabbing was. And what was the second one for you?
For me, it was... when Saoirse Ronan is kind of sneaking around and Willem Dafoe is on the roof and then she pops out her head from like a chimney or like a rooftop tile and then immediately cuts to that somebody got beheaded. And I thought for sure it was her.
Yeah, the way they set up that scene.
The way they set it up, you thought for sure that it was her. And it was such like a gut punch. And then you find out that it wasn't her. But then, since we're in spoilers, like at the end of the movie, she doesn't quite make it because she makes it to the end. But then, like, they say that she died, like, when she was pregnant with Zero, and her and the baby both died from, I think it was like infection or some kind of illness. And it's just something where I was so relieved that, like, she lived, that it wasn't her who got beheaded. That I think, like, if you're thinking about, like, well, what. got me choked up or what makes me feel really sad about the ending is like, you're so hoping, like even more so, because you realize like how much you want this like sweet character who more importantly is the girlfriend of the sweetest guy like right. you could ever imagine, right. like Zero, and she doesn't make it.
Right.
And it's just almost sadder than like I can handle. It's just really tough.
Well, and I had been anticipating that for the whole movie just because the first mention of her name, he basically says, I can't talk about her.
Exactly.
So I when it was tipped that maybe it was her that had been beheaded, I was like, yeah, it's heading that way, you know, and it's not, but I still kind of had it in the back of my mind that she wasn't going to make it. And again, I think it's super interesting that the movie ends before any of that bad stuff. We don't see Ray Fiennes shot. We don't really see her dying. It's just this, it's sort of tossed off in a line of dialogue. So many other movies would just focus on like that for the last entire act of the movie.
And then it becomes a different movie, but it's just so much more effective the way they did it.
Because think about F. Murray Abraham's performance now in light of the information that we're given at the end of the movie, how, like you said, that Zero has led this life of just impossible sadness, that he has just been grief-stricken for years and years and years because he lost his best friend, his idol. He lost the love of his life. He keeps this hotel open as a promise to her. It's it, like you said, it's sadder than you can sort of bear, but you have to think about it and be able to put your head and your heart in that place because the movie doesn't give it to you.
Yeah. And
to its credit.
Also to its credit, F. Murray Abraham is finally living up to his Oscar potential from Amadeus.
That's right.
Between this and Llewyn Davis, he's on a little bit of a F. Murray roll.
Because he makes bad movies a lot of times. He shows up in some real garbage.
But how do you get to Carnegie Hall?
Is that a Last Action Hero reference?
It is.
Okay.
It
took me a second.
Oh, well. It's definitely like... It's a movie that I like, I think, more than I think about it.
Right.
And it's something that I do want to, you know, buy and, like, revisit and everything. But, yeah, it's funny. I think this might have, like, a Book of Eli effect for me, like, where I liked it. But I think by the end of the year, I'll probably feel like this kind of means more to me than it did when I first watched it.
Well, and it's interesting because I'm guilty of this too. I mean, I almost started off this discussion by trying to place where it falls with the rest of his filmography. And,
sure.
And we tend to do that, especially with certain filmmakers and filmmakers that we're passionate about. We immediately are trying to rank.
Mm-hmm.
Where does Django Unchained fall in Tarantino's catalog? You know, is it better than this? Is it better than this? And we're all sort of, especially when they have a sort of a limited, you know, less than 10 movies, because you're not really going to do it with Scorsese anymore.
Yeah, it's too much.
You might say like, oh, top five, but you're not going to. But maybe that's missing the point. I mean, maybe we should just be glad that this exists and we have this new Wes Anderson movie, which isn't something I thought I would be saying before I saw this.
Yeah. It's funny that you mentioned, though, that it could be like a metaphor for him feeling like he's out of time and like underappreciated or whatnot, because I think that at least by judging by like the grosses of the movie and how popular it's been, like in its expansion from limited release to kind of semi-wide release, and the audience I saw with was like completely packed for like a really early showing in the morning.
Mine too.
I think I read somewhere, and this isn't my original thought, he's kind of becoming like a boutique, like a Woody Allen,
right,
where it's like everybody kind of like rushes out to see the new Wes Anderson thing.
Definitely.
And I think that there's an interesting thing that's happening with directors who kind of came of age in like the 90s, because you've got, you know, you got the Tarantinos who kind of had like a string of popularity for the most part, but he kind of had an ebb for a while with Kill Bill wasn't as appreciated as it should have been, and like Death Proof and Grindhouse certainly weren't. But then he kind of like, people sort of remembered how great he was when Inglourious Basterds came out, and like the grosses showed that and the acclaim, and same with Django Unchained. And then same thing kind of with David O. Russell, and I think Wes Anderson in a certain way is kind of like on a trajectory similar to those two, where Here's the thing. David O. Russell, what I mean by it is...
David O. Russell is getting worse.
Okay, David O. Russell is becoming much more populist.
Yeah.
Wes Anderson, I feel like, has kind of figured out how to marry his idiosyncratic nature with a very populist commercial nature.
Really?
I think something like Grand Budapest is no less commercial than like an Inglourious Basterds or a Django Unchained. Like, I'll bet you a quarter right now that Grand Budapest will gross over $100 million. It'll be like,
really?
His first movie. I think it's just going to keep kind of expanding, and he's going to become another director where he was making movies that weren't making that much money, and like all of a sudden now everybody's like appreciating
that, that they're caught up to him.
Yeah, that they caught up.
I think it will be a successful movie for him. I don't know that it will gross over $100 million. I didn't mean to suggest that he necessarily feels unappreciated, because I think he knows that he has an audience, and I think he knows that he gets a lot of critical acclaim. I think it's more just about, like I said, him wishing that the world was still a certain way, because all of his movies are very much about trying to recapture this thing that came before. In Tenenbaums, it's childhood. In Rushmore, it's, you know, life before the mom died, or a certain kind of Renaissance man mentality. Like you said, with Moonrise Kingdom, it's about young love. I mean, his movies are all sort of steeped in this idea for nostalgia of an ideal that existed and is gone. And that's very much what this movie is about. So it's not necessarily, I don't mean to suggest that he feels unappreciated, because I think you're right. I think he's definitely on kind of an upswing right now, that people are finally starting to take notice.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess that's it.
That David O. Russell's fine.
David O. Russell's fine. Did you happen to read Film Crit Hulk wrote a piece?
I heard his voice for the first time, because I know you mentioned he was
that
on
Out of the
podcast.
Blue podcast.
I didn't finish it.
It's not the best podcast.
No, yeah.
But he's an interesting guy.
Yeah, I don't know where he gets his angles from, but like, I'm glad he gets them,
because
they're very interesting.
He wrote a thing at Badass Digest about David O. Russell, about how as David O. Russell gets more successful, he's becoming less interesting as a filmmaker, and that all of the things that once made him great have gone away and are being replaced by this other thing. And it's exactly how I felt and couldn't quite articulate. Mm-hmm. So it was an interesting read. But
it's interesting because, it's just kind of subjective with as far as like what style sometimes responds to you. Because, he's getting, I won't say better and better, but like, I definitely have enjoyed his more recent stuff.
Yeah.
Than his prior things. I like Three Kings, but like the exception of that, before The Fighter, I was really having issues with his stuff.
See, The Fighter for me, and we're way off topic. The Fighter for me is the movie that sort of splits the two.
Yeah.
Whatever. Mm-hmm. Definitely way more commercial, and I thought he would go back to make. I thought that was like his sort of commercial experiment, and then he was going to go back to making David O. Russell movies.
Right.
That didn't happen.
Nope.
Anyway, thank you for listening, everybody. Thanks, Adam.
Thank you, Patrick.
And we will see you guys next week.
Inbox White Hot.